Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. I'm Willem Vanderhorst, your host for the show. For any newcomers, in case you aren't familiar with it yet, in this show I interview creators and thinkers from a variety of fields I find inspiring and interesting, like people in advertising and marketing and media, in game design, other types of design and creativity fields as well. You can find all the show's episodes and subscribe as well on iTunes or on Stitcher. Or directly on the Ice Cream for Everyone website, of course. That's www.icecreamforeveryone.net. Everything spelled out, Ice Cream for Everyone. In addition to giving the show a rating or review, if you enjoy listening, it'd be awesome if you could tell a friend about it, really. Word of mouth stays basically the best kind of recommendation. And if you want to keep in touch with me, if you want to get in touch, if you want to give me any feedback, recommend a guest for the show, ask any questions, you can find all my details on the website. You can also get in touch via Twitter. My handle is @HippoWill. That's @HippoWill. For today's guest, I traveled to Vienna to meet George Nieme, aka iBoy, on Twitter. George hired me when I was looking for my first job as a strategist with a creative agency called Iris in London. I hadn't seen him in several years since I was in Asia for the last few years and was really looking forward to catching up with him. It was a rich conversation. I hope you enjoyed as much as I did. George has a wealth of experience in digital marketing and media with agencies, creative agencies, startup companies, publishing houses, internally with brands. Most recently, he was working at the Austrian newspaper group called Courier. I'm sorry to any German-speaking Austrian people. And anyway, he also gave a talk to the TEDx event in Vienna that was called What If There Was No Advertising? The whole theme of the conference was what if, ... And the link to the video on YouTube is on the show notes, and it's a brilliant talk. I recommend you check it out, as well as the podcast episode. Now, he's in the process of starting a new business, and we talk about a lot of different things during the episode, from the early days of the web while he worked at the New York Times, to the evolution of digital technologies and the way we use them, and a lot more. So without further ado, here's George Nieme. For joining me for this show. I really appreciate you taking the time.
I think it's awesome that you made it to Vienna.
Yes, we are in Vienna right now at the Impact Hub, which is a co-working space that you're based out of, or at least occasionally, right?
Yeah. It's right next to my former home of the newspaper at Courier. It's a really kind of neat serendipitous thing that's happened, that I used to work 50 meters down the street at a legacy business that's wrapped up in all of the challenges facing a lot of the more established businesses on the planet, especially publishers like the newspaper. Mm. And right next to it is this young, vibrant co-working location that's really interested in the new, that has no idea of what space means or legacy means. And it's nice to be kind of playing both ends of the spectrum.
I usually start with a warm-up question. And there's one thing I wanted to ask you. We're friends on Facebook, and you regularly, and I don't know if you probably publish them maybe on Twitter as well, but you often put out the German or Austro-German word of the day.
Yeah, I do.
And I thought, like, where did it start? And what do you choose as words, or how does it come around?
It's a funny question. I think the origin is my fascination with the difficulty of the German language. And that despite 4.5 years with Red Bull 10 years ago, and now 4 years here back in Vienna, I still find it's not quite an insurmountable task, but it's certainly one of the more challenging things I've ever had to do. And I think my Austro-German word of the day is generally a signal to the rest of the planet, or at the very least my tiny little Facebook group, that there are unbelievably hard words out there that I run across, and you just look at it and go, you know, what the hell is this thing? And so I share them along. And
do you have one example? Do you remember?
No, they're really long. I think part of the fun is that they're, for me personally, they're unpronounceable.
Okay.
You know, they're you know, hundreds of letters.
Okay, I'll pick a couple and I'll add it to the show notes afterwards.
Please.
Cool. So we know each other, and you actually hired me way back when you were the managing director at Iris Digital. And that's how we know each other in the first place. And we're catching up a few years later. And, well, first, I mean, you gave me a shot into this industry, so it's a really, really big deal. I wanted to thank you for that.
That's really nice of you to say.
And now that I've started this show, I interview a bunch of different people that are into the world of advertising, digital, and marketing, and publication. And you have a long history in this industry, so I thought it'd be really interesting to have a chat with you and find out more about how you got into it. But maybe a place to start, given there's a lot of different titles, and it tends to be complicated. These days, how do you describe what you do?
At the moment, I consider myself to be a reborn entrepreneur. I'm in the founding phases of a new company. Mm-hmm. I've left my position as a chief digital officer, which is a bit more official sounding, and I've gone back to a world of kind of bootstrap startup funded entrepreneurship, where I'm really looking at trying to take advantage of a lot of the experiences that I've had over the course of the last 20 years and see how to put them together into something that makes some meaning for me and makes things fun for me and keeps things lively, but also meets the needs of the market that's here in Vienna. So I guess the easiest way to put it would be digital entrepreneur. There's a lot of other words we can use, but that probably would suffice.
So if we go back to the beginning, like your studies.
The beginning, yes.
Or even before that. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Rochester, New York.
Okay.
Or just outside of it, in a couple of small towns. So I mentioned this at a talk I gave recently for TED, TEDx here in Vienna, and said, you know, the growing up in Rochester, you get to know the story of disruption a little bit firsthand. You know, that it's the home of Kodak. And so, you know, family members worked there and friends of mine worked there. And you know, these guys sat on the digital patents for, you know, the patents for digital photography for years and years and did nothing. And watching them go through the story of having grown up with this iconic brand in my backyard and watching them be disrupted into, you know, oblivion has a real, I think, probably not so subtle impact on the way that I see the planet and see the business world today.
Yeah.
So that was the childhood experiences, but I suppose more a couple of things happened. If you really want to, as you've said, this is a long form podcast, I'll give you the longer form or the slightly longer form answer. I think there are two real, a couple real seminal moments that got me started. Mm. One of them was in Paris, where I was exposed to a whole lot of art and a whole lot of culture and of visuals that really appealed to me and appealed to my soul and appealed to the way that I think about the planet. This is when I was 19 years old. And you know, back in the 80s. And I came out of that really wondering what that all meant. And so part of my studies after that was in art history. But I was also really interested in the written word. And so, I kind of paired that up with journalism. Did my undergraduate work in those fields. And then my first week of graduate school in 97. At the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School, a guy named Martin Nissenholtz, who founded the New York Times Online, he was their first MD. He was a graduate of the program that I went to, and he came and spoke my first week or the second week of my graduate school, and said, "The future of the gray lady is online." And it's one of those things that just hit me. For whatever reason, you know, I was studying all these things. I was interested in media. I was certainly interested in advertising and marketing. And this guy who is in charge of one of the most respected brands that I knew at the moment, still is in terms of the world of media, says, the future is digital. And he's saying this in, you know, 1997. And I think from that moment on, everything I thought about really kind of shifted and started to tick on a very digital track. Mm. And so the things that I was thinking about in terms of traditional strategy and planning, where I thought maybe I had a career, I started shifting towards, you know, trying to figure out what does that mean in the world of digital? You know, where is digital strategy today? And there wasn't much of digital strategy back then. There was some, but not a lot. And so that was kind of the those are the very really early pieces that got me going, that put these worlds of visual communications, of written communications, of advertising and marketing and media all kind of in the same place, and gave me the opportunity to do something that I've always loved doing, which is playing with the new, you know, playing with the not the established, but playing with the new. And that new back then was the internet, and it still seems to be that way today. So
yeah, cool, thank you. And so you worked at the New York Times for a bit, right?
Yeah, I interned for them when I was at grad school. So Martin gave me a really fantastic opportunity to be with them as they were just getting online. It was less than a year and a half old or so like that. I think actually I got the dates wrong before. It was 95, not 97. Mm-hmm. When I first met him, but no worries. It's like at this point.
The early days.
It was like kind of back in the beginning. But anyway, he gave me this fantastic opportunity. I then went back there and did some project work for them after graduate school as well. When I was in New York, and really felt blessed to be amongst a lot of real pioneers in the age of what the newspaper industry and what the publishing business was going to be going through for the next 20 years, and probably now for the next 20 years again, to see it really at its infancy, and to meet some of the kind of people who were involved very, very early, a lot of whom are still very much involved today.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I worked after that at I spent some time at Advance Publications, for example, over in Jersey City, so across the bridge. But over there, I got to work with Jeff Jarvis, for example, and such a privilege, you know, and still an inspiring part of my daily routine is to still kind of be in touch with him and be in contact with Jeff and to see what he's interested in, but to know a little bit of the trajectory of where he's come from as well, to see how it's gone, is also very good for me to kind of look at, I think for all of us, to kind of say, well, where's our path amidst all this? Because he certainly has changed both jobs and opinions and stuff as well along the way as all of us have.
So quick one, for the people who don't know, do you want to quickly describe who Jeff is?
Yeah, sure. I mean, Jeff is the he was very intimately involved in, I believe, Entertainment Weekly. He was the editor, if I'm not mistaken, of TV Guide, for example. These are hallmark publications in the United States. And then took a management job at Advance Publications, which is the Newhouse family's publishing world. They're like one of the largest private publishers on the planet. They own Condé Nast. They own The New Yorker and all this kind of stuff, for example. And back then, they were with 33 newspapers in the United States trying to figure out what the world looked like. And so I got involved with him and a woman named Deborah and a couple of other people, Peter Levitan at New Jersey Online, these guys all in Jersey trying to figure out how to do publishing and how to do the internet back then. And it was really, really inspiring experience. And Jeff always had a very pragmatic but also very down to earth and but yet fundamental understanding of the way digital ticked, and has, you know, consistently reinvented the way he thinks about the world, I think, but also kept a very strong core belief. So he's at Jeff Jarvis on Twitter, for example. You should start following him today if you're so inclined.
I was recently interviewing another friend in London, Hugh Gary, who was at the very beginning of similar, but with the BBC. So he was working on the first BBC radio website about the same time. Is there any like interesting or fun anecdotes of like learning how to put a website online for publishing for the first couple of years?
Really funny memories from back then. I mean, we did, I did a lot of marketing with them and a bit of consumer research, and we were trying different things. We were trying to figure out how to get people to play, you know, how would people pay for crossword puzzles? Would people pay for international subscriptions? Would people pay for anything? You know, this is 20 years ago that they were still battling with the same questions that we're doing today. But you know, I think for me, one of the neat things was that even at the New York Times, there were people that had little mattresses that they wanted to sleep under their desks every once in a while because they were so passionate about being there. There was a whole afternoon session at least once a week where we would all sit around and try to figure out what domain names we should all go squat and grab, because this, you know, this, in 95, 96, this is when everybody was trying to, you know, what's the perfect three-letter domain that I need to buy, because that's what everybody everybody was doing those silly stories, you know, mm-hmm. stuff like this. But, I mean, it was a very young environment in New York. I think one of the things that I remember from that time and then after, even in the years that followed when I was at Organic or other places in the city, is at that time, you know, it was a real new thing. It was a very young community. It's one of the things I love about being in Vienna now, actually, is that it's a smaller city with a community of people that I feel very, very close to. We know each other. A lot of us kind of fall into the same circles. Whereas in New York, you know, it's become quite the industry, obviously. And so keeping up with everybody is impossible. But back in the day, you really did run across people in the same places at the same time. And that feeling was very special. So it might not be a specific anecdote about what was there, but that feeling was pretty, pretty cool.
Yeah. Then, so obviously you were also working during the dot-com boom and bust times shortly after, right?
From the initial experiences I had with the media, I worked with, I got hired by Organic Online, which was one of the first digital agencies. And Organic was backed by Omnicom. So they were one of the first, the Omnicom 4. I'm probably going to forget all of them, but there was agency.com, there was Razorfish, there was Organic. And there was the fourth one. I'm sorry, I'll forget. But, you know, I think they went out of business. But anyway, and if not, I'm really sorry, guys, that I forgot your name. There were a couple, I think they were at about 100 or 150 people in San Francisco at that point. They hadn't had a New York office. When I joined, the strategy team with John Baker, who you know.
Yeah.
He was my boss before he became my partner at Iris. And he was running the strategy team there, which I helped to grow. I was the 10th person in the New York office. And at that point, the fun anecdote that I can give, I guess, the way things would run there, we did phenomenal, fun, and entertaining, and I think meaningful work in the very early days of the web. We worked for Chase Manhattan Bank. We worked for museums like MoMA. We worked for startups, crazy things like iWeb, which were using, you know, the first radar technology to kind of measure eyewear for online, which failed miserably, but is now like the whole the rage. It was kind of, you could call it reverse business development. In that time, in the pre-2000s, there weren't too many people out there that could do what it is that we were doing. Mm-hmm. And so instead of, you know, us chasing business, most business was chasing us. And I remember monthly meetings where we would have to understand and have to decide on how high to set the bar to talk to the agency. And when I first joined, it was like, you know, we won't take projects for less than 50 grand. After that, it soon became 100 or 250 or 350 or $500,000, because literally our resources were very, very scarce. And there were only so many developers and strategists and designers to do this work. And it became this crazy environment where you really understood, if everybody's asking for this stuff, if there's such a high demand that A, it's going to grow, and that B, it's going to become a much more complex environment and ecosystem as time would develop. Shortly thereafter, or after my second year with them, I got hired by one of the companies that I was working with. Two guys who had an idea in a burger shop in New York. To build a competitor to Yahoo. And they had this crazy idea, these two guys who knew very little about the online world, but knew a lot about marketing and advertising, one from a finance background, the other one that was Jonas Steinman, Bill Doherty, who was the president of the NBA at that time, the marketing director of the NBA, the National Basketball Association. Mm-hmm. And they thought, why don't we build a portal like Yahoo, but give people points for everything they do? So if you look at the news article, you get 3 points. If you do a search, you get 7 points. If you read your email, you get 5 points. If you do anything, you get points, up to 100 a day. And they said, we'll put all these points into a giveaway, into a daily lottery, and we'll give away $10,000 a day. $10,000 a day, $100,000 a month, and $1 million a year. And we'll do the $1 million a year on live television. They got backed by CBS. They gave us $110 million to do this portal. shortly thereafter, Bain and who else got in the second round? Chase Capital Partners, I believe, got in, or one of the other funders came in. We had $240 million in VC by the end of the thing here. We became the seventh largest trafficked site in the United States. It worked. And we filed to go public in the spring of whatever it was, 2001. And a month later, the bottom blew out of the internet. You know, it was like the classic bubble experience. We were right in the middle of this first big boom and bust. It was a blast. I mean, we grew really, really quickly. We really experienced the hyper growth of the first growth of the web, and then really also felt the pain of, you know, what does this all mean? Thankfully, the guys who ran the company were smart enough to know how to kind of resize and rejigger things. They scaled down. They became very lean. They bought Excite, the brand, shortly thereafter, and made it through. Sold to Ask Jeeves in 2002 or something like that, or 2004, I guess. And made it through, although in a very different shape and a very different size. For me, it was a phenomenal learning experience. Not so much of a massive financial cash out, but something that really changed my life, from understanding where the real motivation for founding something new comes from, what kind of drive is necessary to make things happen, the passion that people have behind their own ideas, and that it's possible, that it's really possible to do this. And also just the power of the internet to really make interesting ideas take root.
Yeah.
It was a really phenomenal time to be in the New York scene. And, you know, there were companies like ours, I don't want to say on every corner, but we were certainly not alone.
Yeah.
You know, you had, at the same moment, there was Google was just starting. They had just broken. I remember sitting in the office when Google broke off from Yahoo, you know, or you had DoubleClick that was establishing itself in New York. Real Media was trying to do its own thing. You know, you had lots of these really phenomenal companies that were establishing and that have now become either remnants or the backbone of the modern internet. So.
Hmm. And then, was it shortly after, or at some point after, you moved to Europe?
I got recruited by Red Bull in around that time. And after 9/11 in New York, it became a very different place. I think it's probably not germane for the podcast, but not the easiest moment to be part of the New York startup scene. And my wife and I, you know, I was in the city, she was out of the city, and we got through it, and I did some other work in the meantime, and then started thinking, you know, we really loved being, Katja's half German, half American. I'd lived in Paris, for a while before, and thought, wouldn't it be neat? Mm-hmm. And so I started kind of looking around different places in Europe, and then out of the blue, I got a call from a recruiter looking for a job that was based in Vienna. I'm like, and being the dumb American, I was like, I know where it is, but I had never been there, obviously. And I said, well, is there anything going on in Vienna? And they said, well, that's where Red Bull wants to put a new digital agency. They're based in the kind of countryside outside of Salzburg, but they wanted to bring some tech talent for their first digital kind of agency that they were going to establish in Austria. And so I came over. I fell in love with the city very, very quickly. Made a pretty easy decision to take a try and move over. And in 2002, I moved over. I got married at the time. My wife then moved over as well, and we spent four odd years here in the city. I worked as the chief. What was I? I was the editor. I was the first editor in chief for digital for Red Bull. And built websites for athletes, built websites for events, did a lot of experimental work on different types of projects that they might be interested in. We did the first live blogging for them. I was telling somebody just the other day, I have fond memories of, you know, doing video work where you had very old style cameras. You had to take a lot of video during the day. You'd have to transcode for hours to get the stuff off of the devices and into a computer, into a laptop that you could actually edit with. And then you'd spend the entire night editing a video. And then by the morning, we were desperate to try to get something online that had been done, you know, the day before. And thinking about that process, which was really, really fun compared to today, where basically, if you really, really wanted to, you could shoot the thing with your phone,
yeah,
you know, or whip out your GoPro, slam it into the side of your laptop, edit it up, and be done. And I do this in 15, 20 minutes. Yeah. But it used to take hours and hours and
hours. Do you remember
the
resolutions of the video you were trying to put up?
Yeah, they were nothing. It was like, you know, 14.4 modems or whatever. No, it wasn't that bad. But it's probably like around 480 or something like that.
Because I remember as well the early days of those videos, and then it took hours to try.
Yeah, like I think they were 480p, and I probably have DVDs where we've burned them, and where they were even burned onto DVD at that rate as well. Yeah. Where they're almost unwatchable from some of the stuff that we've done. But it was really, really fun, and we experimented with them on social media and tried to convince the people who were running the company. We're still running the company, that it was really important for them to kind of own a social media space, that it would be really interesting for them to have a dominant position worldwide in being able to bring people together around the spirit of the brand, to say, here's lifestyle, here's action sports, here's bars and clubs, here's all these things that this brand is emblematic of. How can we pull this together into a social network? And so in around 2003 or 2004, we had a beta product, or a beta, as they would say here, that looked and felt a whole lot like Facebook, before Facebook. And it had, you know, profile pages on one side, but then had the world of Red Bull on the other, where basically you use some of the content from Red Bull to inspire these social environments and situations on the other side. And we loved it. We built it up. We had it based on, you know, skiing and snowboarding and skateboarding and all this kind of stuff. And we brought it, and we're funded enough to luckily have the chance to actually build something that was practically, you know, ready for prime time. And then found out that unfortunately, you know, like many brands, even the most modern brands, there's still a lot of fear around, what happens if people get in trouble? What happens if people say bad things about us? What happens if somebody gets drunk and does something stupid and then posts pictures or does whatever? And I think back then there were a lot of these questions that were floating around, because the idea of what's big new modern social spaces was still a fairly unanswered question. We, the guys who were founding this little venture, all had a pretty solid opinion, at least saying, which was, we're not terribly sure exactly where it's going to go, but it's definitely going to go forward. And it can either go forward with you or without you. Mm. And you're either going to get dragged along, or you can be part of it. Mm. And if you fast forward the world forward, I don't think Red Bull necessarily regrets being so entrenched inside of Facebook, for example, today. Mm. But I do know that had they taken the risk of doing that before, that they would definitely have a much better and a much closer a relationship with the people who are intermingled amongst their brand today. And I think they're trying to do that in other places. If you look at what they do today, you know, 10, 12 years later, you can see that they're trying to do that now.
Do you mean the kind of videos where they're sponsoring the dude jumping from space and that kind of stuff?
I think not just the content, but the platforms that they're using. I think they've tried to refocus back on their own platforms. I think they've tried to come up with some things that they're their own. But yet they're still very much dependent upon other platforms and other places.
Yeah.
It's one of the few brands, and there's not everybody that could do this, but they're one of the few, I think, that had very much the ability to say, this is our little universe. And if you want to know, when you, for example, would come to Vienna and be looking for a cool bar to hang out in, that'd be a very easy brand to associate with, to say, you know, when 150 other people or 150,000 other people, depending on scale, would have said that place is a cool spot, or, you know, by crowdsourcing that information, by having that stuff at your fingertips, I think that they would have been a reference point. Okay. And they still are that reference point, except that they've kind of outsourced the platform side of it to other people. And you could argue that it makes it easier for them not to have to manage something like Facebook, but then again, you could argue that wouldn't it be nice if they had 300 million people of their own.
Yeah.
You know, Facebook's a billion and a half billion people daily, so no one's saying that it needs to be that many. But if you look at the world of Red Bull, it's not so hard to imagine that they could have 10, 12, 15 million uniques a day hitting something that they would own themselves. And that's a much more, that's a much closer relationship, I think, to your consumer, to the people who power your brand, rather than having it be someplace else where the data isn't yours, etc.
It has been an ongoing conversation going back and forth, I think, between brands trying to create their own sites and get people online and versus getting into, you know, other places where people hang out, like Facebook.
Yep.
You know, trying to do stuff within MySpace at the time and then within Facebook, but then where, like, now you're coming out of a few years working at a big newspaper, right?
Sure.
Relatively big. Big zone. Oh, it's okay. It's great. Let's riff. It's fine. No, I think those days are, I don't want to say they're over, but it's certainly a much, much, much different world in today than it ever was then. And even for, you know, if you fast forward to today, you know, I've come out of working at Courier. Courier is one of the top five publications in Austria, so it's a big fish in a small pond.
Okay.
But even, you know, even looking at that, it's difficult to see them operating completely independently from everything else.
Yeah.
So, you know, because of the way the platforms have developed over the course of the last 5 to 8 years, and definitely because of mobile, which we can talk about a little bit separately, I suppose. But the idea that you can simply establish your own space as a brand, for example, I think is a very, very difficult thing to do today.
Yes.
And I don't know if it's a... and in some cases, it's probably not something that's very necessary to do. And actually, it probably makes it easier that you've got all these great places where you can run campaigns, do communications, grow a community, and do all this stuff. But it comes with the consequence of what most... I would say, argue most legacy brands struggle with, which is trying to figure out what their data means, what data means to their business, how to harness the power of a very targeted and very meaningful data rather than just aggregating a bunch of it and trying to figure out, you know, well, what does this all mean? And because they've outsourced the platform, they have a much harder time getting any of that data back into their business.
Yeah.
So if you look at the ease, if you switch back to what Red Bull would have been able to do versus what they need to do today, in one world, they would have a much closer knit experience built with their consumers because under the hood, they would be able to leverage masses of data that they don't necessarily have here versus today, where I would say it's not necessarily a more superficial relationship, but certainly in terms of being able to do deep dives on data or kind of meaningful analysis or regressions on where that might take you with from a marketing, communications, e-commerce or whatever basis, there it's one step further. It makes it one step removed from the process.
Cool. You recently did a talk at TEDx Vienna that you mentioned earlier, which is, I'll put the video on the show notes, so
okay.
I don't necessarily have to repeat it, but it's called What If There Was No Advertising?
Mm-hmm.
And so it'd be great to have your thoughts a little bit more on that. We just talked about a couple of things. The content right now is a big buzzword around marketing and advertising. And Red Bull is known in this world for producing a lot of content that is effectively advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just coming out of a media group and a lot of newspapers, which are normally the content creators that live through advertising, but now are having a hard time getting money out of the content that they're usually paid for, which I believe is some of the stuff that you talk about, right?
Yeah, I was really lucky to get invited to speak at TEDx in Vienna. Vlad Gosman and his team did a remarkably cool job of curating, I think, the fifth year of this event here in Vienna. It was 1,200 people at the Volkstheater here in the city, and it was amazing. They had a topic which the theme, you know, they themed TED, and they themed it this year with what if, and so there were what ifs about refugees, about the environment, about traveling to Mars into space, about education and math, about all these things, about aging, about life itself, and then me, the geek, saying, what if there's no advertising? And so I felt, as I said at the end of my talk, you know, it was kind of like standing on the shoulders of giants, because it was a real opportunity for me to kind of just speak a little bit more openly and a little bit more kind of casually about the situation I think we're in, which is, I think, a massive opportunity if seen the right way, but also something that we have to really understand. I think we're at a real crossroads, that there is what I'd like to call the kind of the end of advertising 1.0 of the internet. We've come a long way with the banner ad. We've come a long way with things that look and feel like other media. And when McLuhan talked about, you know, we adopt the habits of old media and shove them into the new media because that's just what we do. You know, he said it much more eloquently than I just did, but basically that's the thesis. And that's what we've done with most internet advertising. We've taken outdoor and made it into a banner. We've taken the TV spot and made it into a pre-roll. We've made the interstitial on Spotify feel like it's a radio. You know, we've done a lot of things like this, and I think that can only take you so far. And I think the people, especially younger people, have woken up to the fact that it's crap and that they can turn it off. And that the rise of ad blocker, while I think some in our industry would, first of all, definitely not like us to talk about. As I said in my talk, it's kind of like Fight Club. The first rule of ad blocker is you do not talk about ad blocker. Second rule is the same. There's 200 million people who are basically saying every month, we don't want this stuff. And companies are taking a tack which is either trying to not talk about it or trying to skirt and get around it. But not a lot of people, some are, but not a lot of people are trying to talk about how to innovate themselves out of the situation, which I think is the only way through. Because defending the past is not the way to invent the future. And in this world that we're living in, where I've come from a background which is all about content, which is all about the consumer, or which is all about storytelling, which is all about engagement with people. And I've been lucky to be, like I said, to have worked at the New York Times, to have worked at the Courier newspaper, to have worked at Red Bull, all of these places, be the media or brands, and also some of my partners and other companies along the way, that have always kind of had the intrinsic sense that it's about telling stories, that it's about an authentic engagement through topics and themes that you can relate to people with, and not about saying, hey, I've got this thing. And that you need to kind of, if you're a marketer, you need to kind of start reversing the equation and understanding how to tell stories or pick topics or themes that will interest people, and then gather some data and think about selling them a product, versus what we do a lot of the time today is try to sell people a product, gather some data, and then figure out how to engage them, tell them stories, and sell them a product again. So I'd like to see a world where we kind of understand how to make that switch. And my talk was a little bit of a wake-up call for both consumers and for businesses. The businesses that really need to figure out how to, like I said, innovate their way out of this dilemma. And I think that it can be done. It just needs a little bit of a focus and a little bit of time. It's not like it's, we had a rocket scientist on stage at TED. So it's not rocket science. I know that for sure. And for the consumers, I think it's also the idea of saying, if you like this thing that you're looking at online, then I can understand why you would want to use an ad blocker, and maybe you want to, but if there's a donation button, then give them €5.
Yeah.
You know, the next time you go to Wikipedia, and Jimmy Wales is doing the fund drive, give him €5. Yeah. What would happen if the whole planet gave Jimmy Wales €5? We'd have a VR, AR, augmented Wikipedia in the matter of a year. I would love to see that. Or brain pickings.
Yes.
You know, another example that I use in the TED Talk, where Popova just an insanely good job of curating worthwhile, valuable, highly entertaining, enriching stuff every single day. And they fund on donations.
Yes.
Which is
a perfect example, because I'm conscious of time. It's a really, really interesting conversation. But it also allows me to move on slightly to, I usually finish with a couple of cool down questions where I start cross-referencing my interests, because a lot of the stuff that you're just talking about are very similar to the conversations I've had with game designers that are into tabletop gaming. And the people I interviewed have been talking a lot about the success of Kickstarter and the comeback of patronage, which is exactly what we're just talking about.
Yeah.
And that seems to be a model that functions really well. I mean, we're for brain pickings, it works. And for other people, do you think it can work for everyone in the same way?
It can work, but the single biggest word that falls on top of that is quality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, trust is one thing. You know, you have to trust who it is you're working with, and you have to be confident about it. But I think it's a really question of quality. I read an article in the last couple of days, which was about the New Yorker, and the New Yorker had been behind a paywall, and then they had a summer that was free. You know, this is past summer, I think, where they opened up their archives and everybody dove in. And when they put the paywall back up, they've had more visits than they did before. More visits than when it was open. And they've had more subscriptions than they did a year before. And I think it's because people were able to finally understand, as a longtime subscriber to The New Yorker, that it's a really high-quality publication. And that as soon as you get that idea across, I think people are much, much more likely to give you the 1, 2, 5, 10, 19, 99, whatever it is that you need to do in terms of this patronage. I definitely love the analogy with Kickstarter. I think that is the you know, like the crowdfunded patronage system. The challenge is for established companies is that that's a much harder model. Yeah. I think you can't go kickstart the New York Times. They have a subscription drive and they're doing okay, and they're worldwide and they've got, you know, a million people that are now subscribing. The challenge in local markets like I'm here is that the dynamics of the marketplace are about the same, which I'll give you the mini explanation is that there's about 10% of people that will subscribe to a publication.
Mm.
But it seems to be a worldwide average at the moment, right? It's like 10% is about the right number. And so if you're in a very small market like Vienna, 10% of the population who reads your newspaper is definitely not enough to fund your newsroom. It's barely enough for the New York Times to try to figure out what to do with a million subscribers, which is about 10% of them as well. But they're on a massively different scale and are still struggling with the same questions. So for younger businesses, for smaller businesses, for the brain pickings of the world, I think it's phenomenal. Or for larger businesses with huge reach, like the New York Times or like Wikipedia, I think it's great. I think the real challenge is for the established businesses that are in the middle and what happens to them.
Mm-hmm. Got it. You have on your website, I've seen it wrapping up, you have this phrase that says be the rapper, not the rapper.
Yeah.
R and not WR.
It doesn't work really well as a podcast, does it?
Where does that come from? What does it mean?
I don't know. That I'd rather be, so rapper as in like the gum wrapper, candy wrapper, or rapper as in Jay-Z or whoever you'd like to think about. So it's about being in the center. It's about being the content and not the rapper. You know, don't be what's around it. And what's around it right now I see as the banners and the traditional advertising, the things that are the filler, as opposed to the content that sits at the center.
Right.
So be the rapper, not the rapper.
Cool. So this is obviously the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. So I've got to ask you, like, do you like ice cream and what's your favorite flavor?
Dude, you see my waistline? Of course I like ice cream. And I like Ben & Jerry's New York Super Fudge Chunk, because obviously...
Excellent. And games, do you happen to play tabletop games? Because they're very popular in Austria as well.
I've played
board games or
Siedler of Catan, for example. I used to play that a lot. I tell you, the thing that changes, here's what changes, is that now my favorite game is Candyland. Because I have a 6-year-old. I'm learning how to play checkers again.
Yes.
So yes, I'm back into board games. They're just slightly for a different age group.
Yeah.
But I grew up with in another life and for another podcast, when I was 19 years old, I was the junior product manager for a company called Kenner Parker Brothers in Paris. And ran Ghostbusters toys while my colleagues ran Mecano and Clue, Monopoly, Trivial Pursuit and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, I've got it somewhere in my blood.
I've got a last question I really wanted to ask, forgot to ask it earlier, and it's about travel, because travel is obviously an interesting question. Oh, I mean, I love traveling. You've worked in this industry in the States, in Europe, and as well as both places like London, mm-hmm. as well as Austria, so kind of like middle continental Europe and yeah. the UK. Is there any like main differences in terms of doing business that you found that spring to mind immediately, or through the traveling for work?
So I've got a theory that I'm going to try to test at some point, mm-hmm. And it's about the qualities of leadership. That are either similar or different between Western Europe and the United States, and specifically between Vienna and New York. But I haven't quite figured out the parameters for the study. But I'll give you the hypothesis that I have is that in Europe, you'll have at the highest level. If you do a survey, at the tops of companies, you're going to have a much more higher weighting of people with legal degrees or lawyers, mm-hmm. And accountants. And in the States, I believe you're going to have a much higher upweighting of people who have MBAs and who have a finance background. And there's obviously a mix of those things as you go through. But I think on a weighting scale, you're going to see this. And what that creates is the you know, if you think about what lawyers want, generally speaking, they want safe contracts. Mm-hmm. And so it takes time for them to generate so it's a longer process that results in something that is secure. It's a good thing in certain cases. On the other side, you have MBAs who I think are much more risk-orientated, who look at success from a business perspective differently than from safety, and that creates a corporate culture that's quite different. The second thing that I've seen that I want to test as well is the impact of age. Austria, for example, is 7.5 years older on average than America. This is the sixth oldest country on the planet, according to the World Factbook, or whatever it is, as opposed to the States, which is, you know, number 37 or whatever it is. So there's a big difference in the average age, not just of your consumers, but of your board members, of your CEOs, of all this stuff. And I think that age also has an impact on mentality. And I'd like to look at both of those things. Mm-hmm. And I'm currently doing a master's degree at the Berlin School of Creative Leadership. Gratefully funded by the International News Media Association. Thanks, guys. And I think, and I've been toying with the idea of part of my thesis being around those leadership characteristics and how those things match up.
Wow.
And so, yeah. But before you chop this off,
yes.
First of all, it's really, really good to see you again.
Yes.
And for those of you who don't know out there in cyberland, you know, Willem did one of the coolest things ever from people that I've worked in the past, and took a bet with me when he joined Iris. And I remember interviewing him and saying, you know, if you come in and you join the company and you do this thing that I know that you're really good for, which was to help me build a team and to recruit people in, that I'll give you the shot to do what it is that you really want to do, which is to get more into strategy and to do what it is you're doing. And I've never seen somebody so dedicated and so absolutely pure visioned on making that thing happen than the man sitting across from me today at this podcast. And for that, I've been grateful for, because I've always thought about how, you know, we use these opportunities and we see where things might be going, and we latch onto it and say, yes, let's go do that. And because he had the courage and the success of doing that, many, many years later, we're sitting here doing a podcast together.
Yeah.
And I think that's fucking cool. So
thank you so much. It is really, really cool. And same to you. I mean, I was looking for somebody who would give me a shot and believe in the fact that I could bring it, basically.
Yeah.
So yeah, thank you.
A damn good thing.
So where can people find you online? Is there anything you want to promote, because you're starting your own thing?
No, not yet.
Okay.
I'm starting an agency called Nime and Partners in the new year. We'll be doing a lot of the things that we've been chatting about right now.
Okay.
A few other things, but if you just put my name into Google, I'm sure you'll be able to find me.
Okay, good.
Follow on Twitter. And I'm always up for a read on a view of the TED video, so feel free to post a link.
All right. Thank you, George. And see you later.
Do we shake hands now?
I- I don't know. We can shake hands if you want.
Well, that was our sixth episode already and the first one for 2016. Thanks again for listening. Really appreciate your time. If you've enjoyed it, how about sharing it with a friend? You can send them a link to the file via email or share it on your favorite social network. I'm sure there's buttons for that somewhere nearby, wherever you're playing the audio file, may it be from your mobile phone, your tablet, or your computer, wherever it is. You can also find more ice cream goodies to read or listen to on the website, which is at www.icecreamforeveryone.net, all the words spelled out. If you haven't checked it out, please check out the Ice Cream Sunday email newsletter. I write a new story every week, and of course every Sunday, usually based on a personal experience, current events, or whatever else I find inspiring every week. There's like a general running theme through them. You can also get the Ice Cream for Everyone updates on Facebook. Just look up and search for our page. You could like it. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle's @HippoWill. And that's about it for now, really. So until next time, have fun. Bye-bye.